The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
Welcome to Health Talk. This is Dr. Donna Kaplan, and I have two wonderful guests, scientists. We have Stephanie Seneff, Dr. Stephanie Seneff here in the studio, and we also have Dr. Judy Carman here, all the way from Australia. And they have been touring the islands and talking about their research. They are just so dedicated to educating as many people as possible about GMO crops and glyphosate and the health effects. And so I want to welcome both of you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be in the studio having a chat to you.
Yes. And so, and welcome, Dr. Seneff.
Aloha. So
aloha.
Glad to be back.
So you've been touring the islands and talking, and how has that been going, and how have people been receiving the talks?
It's been great, and we've been on quite a tour. Poor Judy's exhausted. We're going every day, another talk, and then also activities in between, and we've had
incredible
great response from the people. I love it when I see the young people, and we have young people showing up. A lot of times it's the older people who are concerned, but we've got some very dedicated organic farmers and people who are very, very engaged in trying to change the system. You know, forget about worrying about whether it's bad or not, but just change it, fix it.
Yes, and so you've been to Maui and
yes,
Big Island?
Yes, Maui and Big Island, and then now we're here in Kauai. We have three talks, I hear.
You've done a Waimea.
Yes.
And I just want to point out that this is a pre-recorded show right now. So by the time that this is aired, then Judy is going to have left the island, and there aren't going to be any more talks happening. But it's just wonderful to have the opportunity to have both of you, and especially Dr. Carman here. So why don't you tell me, Judy, tell me about your qualifications and your experience and your work that you've been doing.
Yes, I've got quite a few degrees. So I've got an ordinary degree in science in biochemistry and organic chemistry. Then I've got an honours degree in organic chemistry. And this is a little bit like a mini master's, if you like. It's an Australian degree. Then I did a PhD in medicine in metabolic regulation and nutritional biochemistry in cancer research. And then I went and did a Master of Public Health, specialising in epidemiology and biostatistics. So epidemiology is the health of the population as measured in an actual people. So it's human sorts of studies. In addition to that, I've also worked at or taught at an agricultural college, as well as working in HIV/AIDS and nutrition at the height of the epidemic, working in nutrition at the one of the government research bodies. I've also been a senior epidemiologist in my state government, investigating outbreaks of disease for the state. And I'm currently on the technical expert group of the Cartagena Protocol, trying to provide regulators with skills and documents to be able to assist them in regulating GMOs as environmental releases.
Wonderful. And tell us a little bit about your work.
Well, I got interested in GMOs a long time ago when I saw the first sort of safety assessment that my government regulator had done to state that Roundup Ready soy was actually safe to eat. And I got that document and I had a look at it. And given that my qualifications include everything from organic chemistry all the way to isolated cells, to tissue culture, to animal feeding studies, to human studies, and also, of course, with the biostatistics, I looked at a safety assessment the government regulator had written, and I just found myself pacing up and down saying, you can't say it's safe based on this. This is rubbish. This is just not enough information. And so I actually wrote my concerns down. and sent them to someone, and that ended up on websites in various places, and my government regulator was not happy at all. But unfortunately, the ones that I've seen since then have gotten no better. And in fact, if anything, they may in fact be worse. And I have in fact written a chapter in a book published by the University of New South Wales Press, where I actually review a number of 12 actual reports by my food regulator, covering 28 different GM crops, and I actually look at how this has been, they have been safety assessed by my government regulator, which states, in fact, they state that they're one of the best regulators in the world for GMOs, and just show just how absolutely poor the safety information is for these crops before they come into the human food supply in Australia and New Zealand. Mm.
And what? Tell me more about that. Like, are they required to do any kind of testing?
The only thing that my government regulator requires, well, first of all, they don't require any animal safety assessments at all, and no human assessments either.
So that's, you know, unbelievable.
It's amazing.
And that's for the United States and for Australia?
Yeah, both.
Mm-hmm.
So as I'm describing what happens in Australia and New Zealand, keep in mind, and I'll describe it better later, that the United States has even less requirements. But the only thing that my government requires is to actually do what's called a compositional comparison between the GM crop and the non-GM crop equivalent. So what they do is they get a small number of samples of the GM crop and of the non-GM crop, and they look to see not if the proteins are different, because if these subs, you know, well, the way that GM crops are made, there is a real risk that something new will be made in that crop that they don't expect. These GM crops are designed, generally speaking, to do one of two things. They're designed to either be resistant to a herbicide, so you change the DNA, so now you're getting a new protein being made in the crop, to allow the crop to resist being sprayed with a herbicide. So you can grow the crop in the field, you can spray it with a herbicide, the crop remains and the weeds around it die. And the other major type is where you put some DNA into the plant, so that now you're getting a new protein being made, and that is to kill insects that eat the crop. So instead of spraying an insecticide on the plant now makes it in every cell of the plant, so you can't wash it off when you get home. And these are called BT crops because they're making what's called BT proteins. And they're designed that when the insect eats the protein, it goes into the gut of the grub and causes pores to form in the gut, and basically the gut ruptures and the insect dies. So with all of these, the only thing that the regulator requires is actually to get a small number of samples of the GM crop and of the non-GM crop equivalent, and to look basically at the amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, not the proteins themselves. So there could be a new protein being made there in the crop, and you can't pick it up because mm-hmm. you've just lost all your information. It's a bit like comparing the fire safety of this building to the one, you know, somewhere else, not by looking at the exits, not by looking at the fire plans, not by looking at the, you know, where you've got your fire hydrants and stuff, your fire extinguishers, but by bringing in the bulldozer, knocking down the buildings and counting the bricks. You've just lost all the information you need. I mean, what are the bricks going to tell you? And yet that's about the only sort of information that my government regulator requires. And the problem there also is that with the very small sample sizes, you could end up with lots of big differences occurring in the crop, but you can't pick it up statistically because of the way statistics works. You need larger sample sizes than that. And the other major problem is that there's no definition of substantial equivalence, so therefore everything passes. Even outrageous things such as one corn variety, which is grown quite widely in the United States, either as an individual gene growing in a corn or as a stacked, one of several genes stacked into a corn variety. But with that one, almost half of the amino acids were statistically significantly different, even on really small sample sizes. And my regulator said, yeah, that's all right. You know, that's substantially equivalent. It's a bit like, you know, not having a speed limit. And then, you know, how do you book someone for speeding if there's no speed limit?
Yeah, I mean, what are the health implications?
Well, we don't really know. They could be pretty awful since this is all that's required. There are no human studies required, and I'm still not aware of a single sort of human health study that's been done, except there was some... there was a study done on children for golden rice. But once again, with that, it wasn't fed to animals before they went to children to feed them, and that's a bit of a worry. Because with the gold standard, the way these things are supposed to occur, you know, for a new pharmaceutical drug, is first of all you feed it to animals before you, so you can work out what the positive and the negative effects of feeding it to animals are. And if it passes that test, if it doesn't cause too much in the way of grief for the animals, only then do you actually feed it to humans. And then you go through the four phases of a clinical trial. But GM crops, that just doesn't happen. And the animal feeding studies that they do are just woefully awful. You know, you could drive a truck through it. So the extent that you can do the animal feeding studies that the industry does and still absolutely not be assured that it's safe to eat.
And I would like to make a comment here because I've heard her say this in her talks. Mm-hmm. And what's shocking to me is that a drug is something that a person will take as a prescription. They can choose not to take it if they don't want it. When you put a food into the food chain and all the members of the society are eating this food, it's a massive experiment that you're conducting on your population. The population, that's the study, really. Just throw it out there at the people and see what happens. You know, it's the food supply for the entire nation rather than just specific drugs that people can know I'm taking this drug or choose not to take it if I don't trust its side effects. You know, we don't have that here. And it should be more safety testing rather than less for something that's going into the food supply.
And Stephanie's absolutely right about that, because there's the other thing is you take a pharmaceutical drug because you're ill and you need to take something to improve that illness. So you're expecting to get a benefit from it. So with any pharmaceutical drug, there's this cost-benefit analysis that you can do. Okay, if I take this drug, I'll feel better, but on the other hand, I might get these sorts of side effects. And with the clinical testing that's done before that drug comes anywhere near you, you're pretty well assured to know what the benefits and the costs might be for each individual person. But what happens, of course, with GM crops is that they're fed to everyone. They're fed to everyone's exposed to them, you know. So all of the they're fed to children, they're fed to the elderly, they're fed to people with cancer, they're fed to people with autoimmune problems, and there's no actual determination whether it might actually assist or harm those people at all. So it's fed to people who don't need to eat it. And there's no benefit sort of touted from eating these crops either.
And there's some new technology or new developments in the GMO?
Yes, there are. I mean, the traditional sort of GM crop is where you change the DNA in the plant so that you get a new protein being produced. There's a new lot that are coming through whereby you change the DNA in the plant to get what's called a double-stranded RNA molecule coming out. And the aim there is that they often go back into the plant. They're designed to go back into the plant and either silence a gene in the plant or activate a gene in the plant. That's one type of these sorts of this technology, how it's used. Another type is where you actually change the DNA in the plant to produce one of these double-stranded RNA molecules. Not so it silences a gene in the plant, but that it silences a gene in an insect that comes along and eats the plant. So these are designed to survive digestion. When the insect comes and eats it, it gets into the gut of the grub, gets absorbed from the gut into the tissues of the body, where it silences a gene in the insect. And there are concerns about this because, you know, this is a very early stage of this technology, and we don't know what the side effects are going to be, and we haven't done very much sort of experimentation on on what these double-stranded RNAs do. But there is information, and yet it's still being used in gene technology, still being used to put into plants, and then people are going to be eating them. The main concern there is that we do know from other experiments on non-GM crops that some plants do make these double-stranded RNA molecules and that they can silence genes in people. It's sort of like the plant talks to the human, if you like, and interacts with the human.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other work whereby we know that these things can silence genes in mice and we know that they can silence genes in tissue culture. So early days yet to work out exactly what's going on, but it doesn't look very good. And therefore, you'd think they'd do some really good safety testing on it if they know this.
So they're just developing them now, or have they been approved?
Some are going through the approval process. Quite where these things are in any given country, I'm not quite sure. But there is a view that some of the existing GM crops actually might work by this double-stranded RNA technology. It's just that they weren't quite aware that it was working that way.
And I might add here, too, that obviously because it survives digestion, you might think that it would survive a long time in the environment. It probably doesn't break down very quickly.
That's correct, yes. So they can survive quite some time. These are not like what's called messenger RNAs, which are much more fragile. When they become a double-stranded RNA, they're much more stable and sturdy, and they can last in the environment. And in fact, one of the ways that they're touted being used is actually just to spray them on top of a crop. Much like an insecticide. And if that's the case, you would expect that there would be spray drift. It would drop on the ground as well. It would go into waterways and it could end up being taken up by fish and all sorts of other organisms, as well as people who then drink the water further downstream.
Now, you have done a very important study on pigs. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. Way back when I first saw that first safety assessment, I saw immediately the sort of study that you should do. And after that, I was contacted by a farmer in Iowa in the United States. As you can hear from my accent, I come from Australia. So we decided to get together and do a study between Australia and the United States to actually look to see what the effects of particular GM crops might be. And the reason for doing that in particular was because, you know, farm animals in the United States are being fed GM crops at fairly high concentrations now for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
So you would expect that if there was any ill health effect to be found, you'd expect to find it first in those sorts of farm animals. So, for example, pigs get fed GM corn and GM soy for their lifespan, and the amount of GM proportion of the diet has been going up steadily over years until now it's almost their entire diet. And my colleague Howard Vlieger was saying, we're seeing problems. We're starting to see problems in pigs. And it might just be the boiled frog effect. You know, the water gradually increases around the frog until the frog doesn't realise it's got to jump out at that time. So these changes that are being seen in reproductive health and in gastrointestinal health in these animals, a lot of the younger vets that are dealing with these animals, well, it's just what they expect to find now. The older vets are saying, nah, we never used to see that back a few years ago. You know, back 10, 20 years ago, we didn't see those sorts of things happening. So what Howard was saying was, in particular with the reproductive problems, that sows, which are the female pigs, they're finding it harder for sows to get pregnant in the first place, and then harder for the sows to maintain the pregnancies. In other words, the rate of miscarriage is much higher than it used to be. These days, if a sow's going to get pregnant, it's usually done by artificial insemination. So you buy a straw where you're guaranteed a certain number of viable sperm in the straw. And the genetics of that sperm come from very good quality boars these days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been going at the same time as GM crops have been coming in. So the improved genetics in the males and this guaranteed number of sperm may in fact be overshadowing or covering over quite a lot of the effects perhaps on the males, male reproductive health in these pigs, because there are some religious groups in the United States that are still required to service their sows with a boar. And when they do that, they've noticed a reduction in the number of piglets born. So, and then the gastrointestinal health, Howard's saying, look, we're seeing a lot of inflammation and it's happening through the intestinal tract, particularly in the stomach. And there's an increase now in pigs literally going down in a screaming heap because their small intestine has gotten too thin so that they actually bleed out of their intestine and they go down in his screaming heap and they die within about 15 minutes.
Mm.
And Howard was saying, look, you know, we're seeing much more of this than we used to. And then as a farm advisor, if he advises the farmers to replace the GM feed with non-GM feed, the problems go away. And then when they reintroduce GM feed, the problems come back. So because of this, we decided we were actually going to do an experiment in the United States in a commercial piggery using the sort of GM piggery type of feed, the standard feed that's used, which is a combination of soy and corn. And we were going to feed it to animals for their entire commercial lifespan, and we were going to look for those sorts of outcomes. And when we did that study, and much more thoroughly than the standard sort of industry study, for a start we had quite a lot of pigs, and the industry, when they do their animal feeding studies, have very few animals. And very few animals means that even if you've got very high clinically important things going on in the animals, it's very hard to find them statistically. So we had enough animals to find statistical significance for things that were biologically or clinically important. And we also fed them for their entire commercial lifespan. So we had them for something like 23 weeks on this diet, whereas the industry has them at the most for 90 days. And and in the talk that I give, I talk about the review of 28 GM crop reports that my government regulator has actually done. And in the ones I looked at, the longest feeding period was 1 month. So we fed them for long enough, and the other thing we did was we actually looked for outcomes that were not only biologically important, but also important for human health. So if the industry feeds their crops to animals, quite often they're farm animals that are not physiologically comparable to humans. Pigs are, because their digestive system is very similar. But if they're fed to chickens, for example, they're biologically very not equivalent to human beings. I mean, they have feathers, they lay eggs, they have... You know, they have two stomachs, they swallow grit to help grind their food, and their kidneys don't even produce urine. And when they measure the health of those animals, they'll do things like measure their body weight, where bigger is healthier, which is not true for a human being. They'll also measure the number that die, because, of course, that's a really good measure of human health, with the implication being that if you're alive, you're healthy, and we all know people who are alive and not healthy because they've got cancer or diabetes or heart disease or whatever, and yet according to the industry sorts of standard experiments that they do, those people would be regarded as healthy because they're not dead yet. So we fed them for a long period of time. As I said, pigs are very similar to human beings physiologically, particularly for their digestive system. And so at the end of their commercial lifespan, they went to an abattoir, a slaughterhouse, where the meat went into the human food supply as normal, and we got their stomach contents. So we got their stomach, their intestines, their kidneys, lungs, liver, things like that, and we looked inside those. And we had two major findings. The first one is that the female pigs, of course, have a uterus, a womb, and on average the uterus was 25% heavier in animals fed GM feed than in animals fed the non-GM feed, and that was statistically significant. And there are a number of things that could cause this. All of them have long names, and all of them are not something you would want to have. But it was an important finding, because you remember what Howard was saying. He was saying that the female pigs are finding it hard to get pregnant and finding it harder to maintain a pregnancy. So it may have something to do with the fact that their uterus seems to be bigger.
And I would like to interject here, too, because I am very fascinated by this issue with the uterus. And Judy doesn't mention this usually, but she should point out that this feed that these animals are getting, they have the BT gene, and they also have the Roundup Ready gene that resists glyphosate. Mm-hmm. And the feed was grown in fields where glyphosate was used to control the weeds. So it's quite likely, and she hasn't tested this, that they had glyphosate contamination in their feed. And glyphosate has been shown to be an estrogenic agent at very tiny, tiny amounts. It can cause breast cancer cells to grow. And this is specifically because it acts like estrogen. And so I suspect perhaps that it's the glyphosate that's contributing to the enlarged uterus in these animals.
Right, the uterine lining being enlarged.
Yeah, because they're getting excess estrogen, which is causing their uterus to grow larger. That's a possibility. We don't know. You know, we haven't done enough science to prove that, but I think that's a possibility. And another thing I wanted to add is failure to thrive. I think Judy's probably aware of this because these same farmers have told me that they have a serious problem with piglets, that when they go off of their, when they stop nursing and then they go on to the GMO Roundup Ready feed, a certain percentage, and I've heard as high as 20% of those piglets simply refuse to eat and they get really sick and they die. And this is called failure to thrive. Nancy Swanson and I looked into CDC data, hospital discharge data that the U.S. government maintains, and we found similarly failure to thrive in human infants, and we found that the rate of that problem in humans is going up over time, in step with the increased use of glyphosate on corn and soy crops. So that's yet another one of these correlations. Nancy and I talk about many different diseases that are going up in step with glyphosate. Failure to thrive is another one. And we have a paper that's about to appear where there's a figure in that paper that shows this result.
Mm. Yes, a
good point. You can you could also say that usually they're feeding the animals estrogen, aren't they, to fatten them up?
I don't know if they are. The other thing that might be, first of all, to sort of add to what Stephanie's saying, the thing about the majority of GM crops are actually designed to be sprayed with a herbicide, as I said before, and therefore, of course, you wouldn't be spending that much more money on buying those seeds unless you were actually going to spray with a herbicide. So a lot of GM crops do come with possibly higher levels of glyphosate in them, and the two are usually joined at the hip. So if you've got a GM crop that you're feeding to animals or, you know, you're eating it yourself, then it's likely to have higher levels of things such as glyphosate in it. And the crops that we actually fed to these animals were a mixture of three GM genes, so and including a triple stack variety of corn there. So these are not required. Sort of extra safety assessments are not required if you've got a triple stack plant by any regulator that I'm aware of. Essentially, they regard, you know, if you put one GM gene into, say, corn and a different GM gene into a different variety of corn, a different GM gene into a different variety of corn, if they've gone actually through the individual genes have gone through a safety assessment with a regulator, you can then cross those into, you know, double, triple, quadruple stack, and it doesn't matter. The regulator doesn't require any further safety assessments done at all. So we all know with pharmaceutical drugs that, you know, they can interact, but there's this view that it's not possible for GM crops and their protein products to actually interact. So this is one of the reasons why we actually fed this to farm animals, was the standard sort of thing that these farm animals eat, which includes stack varieties that are not safety assessed by regulators. But it's a real-world experiment. It's exactly what animals eat, and it's how people eat as well.
And I would like to point out that it's amazing how far away the experiment Judy is doing is from the experiments they did in the controlled laboratory experiments that they did to try to get these things on the market. You know, just the fact that it's all these genes combined, plus the glyphosate, and she hasn't mentioned this yet, but when they test these genes, the GMO Roundup Ready gene, they grow the crop without the glyphosate. I find that absolutely shocking. Judy talks about that in her in her talk, and it's just stunning to me that you don't even test it. The gene is there to give it protection from glyphosate. Of course you're going to use Roundup on the crop, but when you test its toxicity, you leave that part out. I find that really amazing. And, of course, Judy's incorporated all of it, which, you know, and there's this extreme point of view where you say just test this thing in isolation, and you have a controlled experiment. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't have a controlled experiment. She has all these factors going on, these genes, you know, and these chemicals. So she doesn't know exactly what is causing these problems, but she's seeing these problems. Mm-hmm. And there should be follow-on. I mean, people should be excited about her results, and other researchers should be eager to try an extended experiment that would try to tease out some of the differences that she's, you know, try to figure out which of these factors, and probably, as she says, in synergy, are causing these problems. We need to answer these questions. And yet all they do is just kind of, you know, try to discredit her because she's revealed something that they don't want people to know.
Mm. Yes, so the control group there was one that wasn't fed the GM feed. They were fed a non-GM equivalent diet. And the other thing, of course, is Stephanie's mentioned the glyphosate, possible effect of glyphosate on the uterus. There's another possibility as well, and that is that the actual GMing the soy may have changed the phytoestrogen content in the soy. But the other thing that we, so there are a number of things that could all be interacting here to actually cause this effect. And when you do a real world experiment like this, you actually put those things together as they exist in the real world and test them as they sit in the real world. So it's the soy is sprayed with glyphosate and they joined at the hip in the farmer's field. They joined at the hip when you actually eat those soybeans, and so that's what we did with the pigs. But the other main thing we looked at was this intestinal sort of inflammation, this gastrointestinal inflammation. Mm-hmm. Now we had... We couldn't look inside the small and large intestine because these animals are just so big. And to look inside the intestines, you've got to slice all the way up the side of the intestine. Oh, obviously, the animal's dead by this stage. And you get the intestines out. You've got to slice all the way up the side of them, and you've got to flush them out with usually phosphate-buffered saline before you can actually look at the inside surface of the intestine. So it was just too hard to look. But we could look inside the stomach. Mm-hmm. So we got the stomachs and looked inside them with veterinarians who had years and years of experience with pigs, and they, before we started this study, got other pig stomachs and looked inside them and worked out a grading system of nil inflammation, mild, moderate, and up to severe inflammation. And then at the time of the end of this experiment, they were blinded as to which stomach came from a GM-fed or a non-GM-fed pig. So their thoughts on the subject did not influence one way or another what they found. And when they looked inside those stomachs, there was a significant difference in that severe inflammation. It seems that the diet of pigs in piggeries in the United States, or hog farms, that's an American term, in the United States is such that their finely ground diets can irritate the lining of the stomach a little bit. But if you add the GM feed to it, it boosts that up to severe. And when I talk about severe inflammation, it changes the stomach, the inside of the stomach lining, from a sort of a light beigey colour up to one that is bright, sort of cherry red or strawberry red in colour. Mm-hmm. And you can see it sort of inflamed. And you look at this stomach and you go, I do not want that. Mm-hmm. So amongst the female pigs, having that sort of stomach was over twice as likely if you were fed the GM diet. But if you were a male pig, it was four times more likely. Yes, so there's not very good not very good sort of findings for the industry, which is probably why we got so comprehensively attacked at the end of it.
At the end of your study.
Yes, once it was published, we got comprehensively attacked by them. All sorts of commentators from around the world were writing silly comments about this, trying to find other reasons for why we found the results that we found. And I should say that there's a website, which isn't one that I run, but which is a fan site, but they're very good at putting pictures of pigs up there and actually putting rebuttals from what people associated with the industry write. And that's called gmojudycarman.org, where Carman is spelled C-A-R-M-A-N. So that's gmojudycarman.org. And if you have a look there, you can see the pictures of the stomachs and you can see all of the rebuttals of the silly arguments raised by people associated with the industry trying to say how it could not possibly be due to the GM diet that we got this increase in inflammation.
Can you say what they think it's due to? Because it seems so obvious that that's the difference between the two. It's hard to imagine that they could even come up with some excuse for why this wouldn't be true.
Yes, well, it's entertaining reading their reasons. It's just it was entertaining writing a reply too, quite often, I can assure you of that. And not only replies written by me, but by other people are up there. I mean, some people, I just wonder how they can add up, and yet they, you know, sort of pass themselves off as some sort of statistician. It's real head-scratching stuff. But, you know, there were allegations that that the differences in inflammation were caused by, oh, I don't know, something, but we controlled so much in this diet. I mean, we were so thorough with what we were doing that we were quite happy that at the end of it we were able to say, nah, it's the GM diet that's causing this. Everything else was controlled out of the experiment.
That's the beauty of that experiment, too. It's so clean because it's exactly the same group of pigs and exactly the same place even, except for just the feed. It's the only difference.
And the feed was even ground on the same equipment, so it was the same grind size, and the people who were looking after the pigs didn't know if they were fed GM or not. There was one guy who mixed the feeds, and he just called them, you know, Diet A. In fact, we even had, you know, there were two diets here, we even had groups A, B, C and D in the pigs so that it was hard for the handlers to work out which pigs were fed GM and which were fed non-GM. So they just handed out Diet A to Group A. So they didn't even know. But it was interesting. There were a number of pig handlers who actually came up to me at the end of the experiment and said, I reckon I know which group's fed GM. I'm going, okay, which one? And they were correctly picked the pigs.
Interesting.
And they correctly picked the pigs on the behaviour of the pigs because they said the behaviour of the pigs was of the GM-fed pigs was just a little bit more crazy. Mm-hmm. They said that they were irritable. They were kind of looking for a fight, and they'd bite each other and they'd pick on each other more. And that was another anecdotal finding of Howard Vlieger. He said that he'd been at one stage phoned up by one pig farmer where he suggested that he change the diet, and he found a new diet for that pig farmer. And the pig farmer phoned him up and said, you know, what have you done to my pigs? You know, we're having this discussion about, well, what do you mean, what have I done to your pigs? My pigs are different. Well, what do you mean? And here the pig farmer was saying that now the pigs would go to the feeder and eat, and they would go to the water dispenser and they'd drink, and then they would lie down and be content. Because beforehand, before the diet was changed to the non-GMO diet, he said that the pigs would fight, they'd bicker, they'd pick on each other, and they were just restless. And now they weren't. Mm-hmm. And so on the basis of the behavioural change, there were some of the pig handlers said, oh, we think we know, you know, what do you think? And I was not able to unblind them until all of, you know, the pigs had been processed. But I was then able to tell them that, yeah, you're right. And the other way that some of the pig handlers worked it out was by the smell of the intestines. They said, these pig stomachs, these pig intestines over here in these buckets with cold PBS in them, they stink.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on that basis that they said, we think that they're the GM diet, to which all I could do at the time was just sort of nod sage and go, oh, well, that's interesting, thank you, I'll keep that in mind. Because, of course, they still needed to be blinded for all of the autopsies. But at the end of the autopsies, I was able to tell them that, yeah, you're right, it was them.
And I would comment on glyphosate again here because glyphosate is known to disrupt the gut microbes, and humans have an epidemic in inflammatory bowel disease, which sounds like the same thing that these animals have. And so I suspect again that the glyphosate is playing a role. And I don't think the BT gene is going to be a picnic either, because that blows up the stomachs of the bugs that eat it.
So imagine
you might
what
expect
it's doing
it might
to
do
humans.
Something to the bugs, to the stomachs of the animals.
Yeah, so in addition to the glyphosate, you've also got what these plants are designed to do and the genes that they put in. And these BT proteins are ones that are designed to irritate the gut of the insects so that it actually ruptures. And in this diet that we fed them, there were two BT proteins actually being produced by these plants. And it may be the case that one protein by itself may not cause any real problems, but the two of them together may act synergistically to be actually cause this sort of inflammation.
Mm-hmm. And this is a typical diet for commercial hog farms, right?
That's right. Yep, very, very standard sort of diet. Yep.
Yeah, I worry about pregnant mothers who are eating.
Well, I do too, and I worry about them for another reason. Of the sort of the four major things that could go wrong with GM crops that haven't been assessed, there's allergy, which I can talk about how that's been assessed, but it's been woefully inadequately done. It's mainly just a sort of a computer sort of determination about whether it, you know, so basically they don't feed it to animals and they don't feed it to people to determine if they're allergenic. Cancer, they don't feed it to animals for long enough for cancers to develop. Then comes sort of reproductive health. There are no requirements for any studies for reproductive health from eating these at all, and there are also no requirements for determining what happens to the unborn baby. You know, what happens to the unborn pup of a rat or whatever, none required whatsoever. So not even any determination to see if the pups get born looking a little bit strange, nothing. It's called teratology. None of that's being done. Mm. And then there's the toxicity studies, which is, you know, is it going to harm your kidneys and your liver and your lungs and that sort of thing? And that's the sort of thing I've been talking about. And that's also been, a little bit of that's been done, but it's woefully inadequate. So I worry about reproduction as well, because, you know, the pigs are suggesting to us that there could be reproductive problems. But the reproductive lifespan of a human is in the order of 20, 25 years. So we're just now coming up to the point in time whereby people who've been fed GM crops from birth are now starting to want to have babies. Mm-hmm. And so there may be things happening there in the background that we're just not aware of because we haven't been made aware of it yet. And so we may become aware of, if there are problems with reproductive health in people who've been eating GM crops for that long, since they were weaned, then it could be a nightmare that we just don't know about yet.
Yes, and I would comment, you know, again, looking at the human statistics, there's been a remarkable drop in the number of teenage pregnancies in the last couple of years, and a significant decrease. And, you know, you could say, well, maybe these teenagers are being very good and very careful not to get pregnant, but you could also say simply that they're having fertility problems. And we may be beginning to see the effects of this lifetime exposure to GMO.
Right. It would be unusual if teenage pregnancy would have gone down so dramatically.
Right. It was a dramatic drop over the past year,
Just in the past year.
Yeah.
And, of course, that would, unless you brought in some marvelous new educational process that that all the teenagers are actually being exposed to and they're listening and they've stopped becoming teenagers and stopped taking risks. Yes, it looks a little bit too suspicious to me, I'm afraid. I'm worried about things like that.
Stephanie, have you seen anything in your research on glyphosate?
Linked to reproduction.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know enough about infertility to be able to comment on that, but I do know that it will affect the reproductive system, and I am particularly concerned about retinoic acid. Glyphosate disrupts the cytochrome P450 enzymes in the liver.
Right.
And one of the things they do is break down retinoic acid. That's vitamin A. And retinoic acid is very, very, it plays a very important role in development. And so, but it needs to be very carefully regulated. It's produced and then it's taken away. And the timing is very, very crucial to get all of that to work correctly. But if the part that takes it away isn't working, then you'll get too much. And when you get too much, you get teratogenic effects. You get defects in the kids. And one of those things, for example, is anencephaly. And in my talk that I give in this series, I have a section where I show a particular example of an epidemic of anencephaly. Anencephaly means no brain. The child is born without a brain. And so this is a major problem with the neural tube in the development of the child. And there was, in this particular area in Washington State, in Tacoma, Washington, they had way more cases of this. This is a very, very rare disorder, as you might imagine. Mm-hmm. And they had essentially an epidemic of it. And it was an area where lots of different chemicals were used in the farms around that area. Mm-hmm. But they were also, it turned out, over the two-year period in which they had this epidemic, they had greatly increased the amount of glyphosate that they were using to kill weeds in the waterways. And and the funny thing is, when they did all the studying, they studied all these different chemicals that they were using in agriculture, but they didn't study glyphosate because they considered it to be harmless to humans. Yet glyphosate has been shown to cause microcephaly in tadpoles in a published scientific study. And they suspect that it's due to the effect on retinoic acid. So all of that makes sense to me. And yet they were just clueless. In their study, they didn't even think to look at it, which is frustrating. I think that's one of the things about glyphosate that I find very disturbing, that people generally believe it's extremely non-toxic to humans, and they always think that's the best herbicide to use. As a consequence, it's used in huge amounts. It's by far the most used herbicide worldwide, but particularly in the United States. We use 25% of the world's market of glyphosate in this country. And I think we're really suffering the consequences in terms of a lot of the ailments that are going up in frequency in step with this increase in the usage, which again is due directly to these GMO crops because they are finding this huge problem with resistant weeds growing among the glyphosate-resistant weeds growing in among the glyphosate-resistant crops. So they have to use more and more in order to be able to kill the weeds.
More glyphosate and more of
and then other herbicides. I mean, they're now starting to design GMOs. They've got them already that are where they can be, again, you know, multiple genes, one to resist glyphosate and one to resist another herbicide such as 2,4-D or dicamba. And then they've got the product ready to go that's got both of those herbicides in it. Again, with, and she talks about all these stacked genes and no testing of the stack. But you also have stacked chemicals and no testing of the stack there as well. And you can only imagine that these chemicals are going to be synergistically toxic.
And there's been just recently released and actually starting to be grown in fields in the United States an 8-stack where it's resistant to 2 herbicides at the same time and have 6 of these BT genes and therefore proteins expressed in it.
So all in the same plant.
All in the same plant.
And it must be the case that the BT is also running into trouble, right? Because now they've got 6. They had started with just 1. I mean, is there a story behind that? Why they have to use 6 and why not just 1?
Yes, it's my understanding that resistance is coming from insects as well on some of the BT proteins, some of the insecticidal proteins.
This is a war we can't win, you know, because our enemies, these weeds and these insects, are always going to outsmart us. And we have to just keep on adding more and more chemicals, and we're going to poison ourselves more and more along the way. We have to, you know, step back and say, oh, what are we doing here? We have to do something different in the way that we grow crops.
Well, these are chemical companies, so they're trying to make a profit.
Yeah.
And they're really doing that, aren't they? No, I mean they're designing crops that need more and more chemicals.
Right. I mean, it's really sad that the people who are designing and delivering these patented genes are the very same people who are producing the chemicals that poison you, that go with them. So you obviously, if you're going to spend the money for this gene, you're going to also spend the money. And in fact, Judy said, farmers have to sign an agreement. You can correct me if I'm wrong, that they have to use the very same chemical that company produces.
That's right.
To go with the gene that the seed that you bought that has that gene in it that resists that chemical.
Yes, we've already talked about how one of the major types of GM crops that are made are actually made to be resistant to glyphosate. So therefore, a farmer could get hold of they've got to go to the when they buy the seeds, they've got to sign a technology user agreement that says several things. One of which is that they're not going to do any experimentation on the crop. They're not going to give it to anyone else to do experiments on either. So therefore, it's very difficult for independent researchers like myself to get hold of the materials to test.
Right.
It's a big problem. But in addition to that, and also in Australia, there are gag sort of orders within that technology user agreement so that if the crop does badly, they can't tell their neighbours. And in addition, it all started really when glyphosate was about to come off of patent so that you could actually buy generic glyphosate. So these technology user agreements, if they use glyphosate and then a Monsanto product, written in the technology user agreement is that they have to use Roundup.
They're
not allowed to use the generic product. They've got to buy the Roundup for the crop from Monsanto, and it's all tied together into one agreement.
That's a really good trick to keep the patent alive, essentially, for longer, because you sign the agreement when you buy the seed that you have to use the Monsanto product.
Yeah, the glyphosate in other formulations is coming out of China really quite cheaply. It would obviously be more likely to be more expensive buying Monsanto's Roundup product. And so it ties people into using Roundup rather than cheap Chinese glyphosate.
Is it just glyphosate, or does it have the other additives that Roundup has? Do you know?
Yes, I mean, that's another whole issue with respect to these products because, again, and as Judy has said, all this testing in isolation, in their regulation, they're required to test glyphosate in isolation. They're required to do that. And as soon as glyphosate is tested in the context of these products, these formulations, that no longer counts as far as the regulators are concerned. They've been able to throw out papers that have shown toxicity of Roundup on the grounds that Roundup is not glyphosate. And yet the formulation is made specifically to make glyphosate more toxic to the weeds. And so you can imagine that if it's more toxic to the weeds, it's also more toxic to us. And then these other things that they add both increase the toxicity of glyphosate and are themselves toxic in and of themselves. And so it's just, and so the formulations are changing constantly. And I think there's been some serious changes in the effects of these products on us as a consequence of new introductions of new formulations that are more toxic to the plants. We've been trying to figure out this giant puzzle because we see increased things are going up. A lot of diseases are going up mm-hmm. over time. And at 2006, they start to go up faster. So there's a corner of
which
several
diseases
different diseases.
Are you thinking?
Let's see if I can remember which ones they were. At this point, I have to refresh my memory. But we're looking mm-hmm. at all these different charts. And there's a subset of them that are going up more faster after 2006. One of them, of course, breast cancer actually was going down until 2006, and then it turned a corner and started to go sharply back up again. Mm-hmm. So that's one example. And there's issues with the children, too, that are going up faster after 2006. Maybe even like the failure to thrive, but I have to go check the curves to be sure. There's a lot of curves we look at, and I can't remember exactly which ones. But so 2006 is when they start talking about glyphosate salts. Nancy Swanson's been looking at this data with me, and she's gotten the data off the web for the glyphosate. And before that, it was mostly something just called glyphosate. And then in 2006, it's something called glyphosate salts. And when you rummage through the patent documents, you find patents that Monsanto has issued, has put requested on adding oxalic acid. And that mm-hmm. we think the oxalic acid is part of the salts. And we're seeing issues with people getting kidney stones and things like that. There would be a direct consequence of excess oxalic acid in their
right.
blood.
Mm-hmm.
So we're suspecting there may be contamination with these extra salts that's causing additional health issues.
Mm-hmm. And so do you know if the generic has...
I don't know. I mean, everything,
no one knows.
And they don't have to list what's in the ingredients because it's under patent protections. This makes it very, very frustrating that you have this product, you don't know what chemicals are in there, and when people get ill, you don't know how to connect it to that because you don't have the information. There's a lot of issues with trying to track down this giant puzzle. You see people getting sick and exactly what's causing it. How do you explain it? Very, very difficult to figure all that out. A giant puzzle that we've been grappling with.
So it's so important to eat organic food.
Absolutely. That's the message. That's the wonderful, simple message. Just buy organic.
And know your farmers who are growing
the
organic.
Yes, that's right. You need to actually become very knowledgeable about who's growing your food and how are they doing it if you want to be healthy. And, you know, the extra money you spend on the organic, I think you'll get it back in huge amounts by the health issues you won't have. Health issues become
Absolutely.
Very, very expensive very fast. Plus,
Absolutely.
You're not happy if you're sick. I mean, you're suffering all these symptoms that you wouldn't have to suffer if you had just eaten the organic food all along. So it's hard for people to appreciate the mm-hmm. need when they're not sick and they can't taste the difference. Mm-hmm. It's really frustrating that we can't taste the glyphosate, for example. We need to evolve genes so we can taste it and we can know that has glyphosate, I won't eat it. Because some animals, I think, the animals have a lot more sensitivity. They won't eat the GMO corn. You know, there's some experiments where they put out the GMO and the non-GMO corn available to animals in the forest, and the GMO corn stays untouched, and the non-GMO has all the kernels stripped from it because the animals know that's the healthy corn. They can tell in tasting
mm-hmm.
it, and
mm-hmm.
we don't know what they're tasting, but we clearly mm-hmm. can't, you know, which is frustrating. We need mm-hmm. to have a better sense of taste. To know, I'm poisoning myself, I can't eat this.
Yes, it's unfortunate that if you're wanting to avoid GMOs in the United States, you've got to go to organic food because you don't have labelling. Whereas in
Do you have labelling in
Australia?
Australia?
We've had it for ages.
Wow.
As has New Zealand,
decades,
as has the European Union. I think the European Union has had it for something like 17 years, 18 years, so getting on towards about a generation, you know. Mm-hmm. And I know that what's being told to you is that if you have labelling, the sky will fall in and, you know, the cost of food will double or something or rather like that. Well, what a load of rubbish. I mean, it's not happened in any one of the 64 countries that have legal requirements for labelling.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it didn't happen in my country, it didn't happen in New Zealand, didn't happen in all the countries of the EU, so... Yeah.
So in your country, you can avoid GMO crops.
Yes,
we've GMO foods.
Our labelling isn't quite as good as Europe. Europe also labels oils that have come from GM crops, whereas my food regulator doesn't require that. But certainly, you know, it, written on the side of food, if you've got something there in a substantial, like corn into corn chips, or soy into tofu, or soy into soy milk, or something like that. That all has to be labelled. Mm-hmm. It's only the heavily refined stuff, such as the oils, starches and sugars, that don't have to be labelled. But yep, and what and the way it looks like on the label is you'll have soy, in brackets, genetically modified, end of brackets, comma, corn, brackets, genetically modified, end of brackets. And, you know, and it's just done like that for every ingredient that might come from a GM crop. But you, what happens then is that because, you know, the manufacturers then need to label it and consumers might have a choice, they decide that they don't really want to have GM in the food. And so it's actually very hard to find a label in Australia that has GM in brackets on the label. I saw one the other day in a supermarket, but that was actually a tin of food that had come from the United States.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and we don't get much food, sort of processed food, coming from the United States into Australia.
So most of your food is not GM then, right?
Well, one would think so, although there's not a lot of safety, there's not a lot of testing of the labelling laws to see if people are actually, you know,
that's another issue.
Trying to cheat.
Right.
But no, you would look on a whole pile of labels in supermarkets and hardly see any mention of any GM
that's
on
interesting.
It.
Interesting. I imagine here it would probably be like 70% of the food or something. I've heard something like that.
No, not
would
necessarily.
Have something in it that was GM.
Well, that might
certainly
be because some
food.
Of the, yeah, some of the starches and sugars and oils and stuff, if that includes
they're everywhere.
Those.
Yeah. They're everywhere, yes.
Yep. But other than those
even the high fructose corn syrup is in everything, and that's from
it's in everything
protein,
in the United States, but it's
protein,
in
right?
It's in hardly
soy oil,
high fructose
cottonseed oil.
Yeah, high fructose corn syrup is in hardly anything in Australia.
Oh, that's
good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Hardly anything. Only in, I was impressed when I came to America for the first time. I saw, oh, goodness me, everything has high fructose corn syrup in it. No.
Well, the United States subsidize corn farmers, so that's part of it. Yeah.
And there's also, of course, the ethanol for gas. And, I mean, that's an issue here, I think. There is ethanol in the gas here. And I saw a paper that was studying the ethanol in gas and finding that it was toxic. They were supposed to be, and they touted as being somehow, just like with the oils, a healthier choice, that somehow the ethanol would have less toxicity, but actually they were finding otherwise. And I am suspecting that it might be the chemicals that are in the ethanol that's causing the problems. If you imagine burning glyphosate, you know,
Wow.
That's got to be bad.
It's got to be.
The other thing about the sort of ethanol industry, as you've said, it's come a lot from corn. There was a genetically modified version of a corn that came in whereby they actually put, you know, a part of the processing of the corn requires a particular things to be added to that in a factory. They decided to genetically engineer corn to be able to do it itself. And that required inserting a gene that was a hybrid of several deep, from organisms from deep sea vents in the ocean, because they could cope with high temperature and high pressure.
Oh.
But then what happened is it came to my food authority is, please, can we let this into the human food supply? Because they knew that it would human corn supply would be contaminated with it.
Right.
Yes. And can I also say that when it comes to, you know, food regulation around the world, and I've described how my regulator operates, your regulator, the FDA in America, requires even less. So there's a completely voluntary system in the United States. So a company that wants to make a GM crop doesn't even have to tell the FDA that it's going to come onto the market. Now, in reality, the GM crop companies have volunteered to give the FDA information that, you know, they want to put a GM crop on the market and to give the FDA sort of information about that crop. However, people would then think that the FDA would do a safety assessment of it and actually declare it to be safe, but that doesn't happen either.
Mm.
What happens is the FDA may look at the information given, ask some more questions, and at the end of it they say, thank you, GM Crop Company. We have no more questions. We understand that you, the company, says it's safe to eat. So they don't ever declare it's safe. And that leads to a situation whereby if these are found to be harmful later on, the company itself may be sued in the United States.
Well, it is time. Unfortunately, we've gone over time. And this was so wonderful to have you both here. And Judy, I want to thank you so much for coming all the way from Australia to educate us on all of our islands. And Stephanie as well,
all
the work that you're doing, and both of you are just so dedicated to, you know, educating as many people as possible. And this is just so important. This is the most important issue for health, for well-being, of the planet, of humans, of animals. It's so important.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your islands, and it's a pleasure to be speaking to you in the studio.
And always a pleasure to come here to talk. I always enjoy it. Thank you so much for doing it.
Thank you. All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Go well. Aloha. Ahui ho.
Aloha, everyone. It is just 102 here on the island.